there. You're listening to the GamesIndustry.biz podcast. I'm Rebecca Valentine, and I'm joined today by
Matthew Handrahan,
Brendan Sinclair,
Marie D'Alessandri,
and James Batchelor.
So this is actually my last podcast as a staff member at Games Industry, and so James and the team have kindly allowed me to take control today and yell about something that I care a lot about. And aside from what I wanted to talk about is kind of the plight of indie games, and not necessarily just like any independent studio. Independent studios and the issues they face, that's a whole thing. Like that could cover many, many podcasts. But what kind of prompted this was an interview I did with Ava Carr, the CEO of Glitch, earlier this month, about their very, very early stage fund that they have just announced for small developers. It's called the Moonrise Fund. You should go read the piece because Ava has some really great things to say about it. It's really cool. But I think one of the critical points that they make is that there are very, very, very few options for specifically like relatively new independent developers to get very early stage funding to start making interesting projects. There's like this big gap there that they have to leap over. And one of the points that they make is that as a result, you tend to largely see people who have other sources of support make that initial jump. So like, you know, maybe a developer has a partner to support them, or like, you know, they're living with their family, or they have a second job, or they have like money set aside or something. But that ends up, you know, locking a lot of people out of that option because, you know, a lot of people who have incredible ideas and talent just don't have those support networks. And so these games just never get made and they don't see the industry as accessible for that reason. And I guess this is kind of a sprawling topic because I really do want to talk about, you know, kind of the issues that really, really, you know, interesting new ideas from, you know, very small teams or individuals kind of face in this industry. But I think that's kind of where I want to start. Like, do you all agree that there's sort of like an early stage funding gap? And I guess like how does the industry address it beyond just this one fund? Because like Ava said rightly that it's very risky to fund early stage projects like that. But they believe it's worth it. But, you know, I mean, maybe other people don't. I don't know.
Well, there's quite a lot of gaps in funding, I think. That's definitely one of them. One of our investment summits, we had a really interesting talk about, you know, once you get beyond a certain amount of funding, there's another like really, really huge gap. And that turned out to be one of the biggest stories that year because it just resonated with people. Like there are gaps in funding. The thing with Moonrise that struck me is like I'm really interested to know like how... Because obviously, like, you know, on some level, like this is a more altruistic way of looking at funding. But all funding is fundamentally a commercial transaction. It's not charity, right? So there must be some mechanism of return on investment, even for a fund like Moonrise, which is trying to target people that aren't ordinarily covered by funding. And obviously what they're looking at is very, very early stuff. So like prototypes, effectively, is what they're talking about. And there's a product that they mentioned called HyperDot, which is, I mean, I don't want to call it that. It's a very sort of sparse in its aesthetic. It's not like a hyper-casual game at all, but it's got that very, very... you know, it's got a couple of mechanics at play. I mean, the problem is that hyper casual is such a loaded term now, but it does resonate in a similar way to that. Like, it's a very simple game. Looks like a very simple core loop there. My main question about Moonrise, I suppose, is where do they cash out? How do they think about cashing out? Because obviously, you know, their investments go up to sort of $250,000, which is a lot of money, you know, for any fund.
Yeah. So my understanding of it is that, so yeah, it's like $250,000 up to that amount in exchange for equity in the studio. No voting rights needed is what it says on their website. And if I recall it, I've got the piece in front of me. But kind of the situation is that there's not a set time that they cash out because one of the things that Ava says is that it can be. Especially for studio, the kinds of studios that they're funding, it can be really, really challenging to have like, you know, a set time when, okay, we need to recoup, like you need to give us, you know, money back or whatever. Mm-hmm. They don't have that. It's based on when the studio itself starts seeing, you know, profit and starts seeing returns. And then, you know, I assume there's some sort of term, like, you know, people get like a certain amount of that, but there's not like a set date or time when that's supposed to happen. So there's not a situation where the studio is like, oh, you know, we're running out of money. Oh, wait, now we have an investor who wants their money back right now. Now we're really in trouble.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. I think that speaks to the one of the issues that the much smaller developers face is that a lot of investment is handed over on terms that just simply don't apply to the kind of work that they do. A lot of investment is, now I accept that Moonrise is equity-based, but equity-based often comes with the pressure to eventually sell your company. These sorts of companies are never going to get bought, right? So I'm assuming Moonrise has some sort of arrangement where maybe if it does want to cash out, that's paid back from kind of studio revenue if they're in a position to do so, something of that nature. But a lot of funding is given over on the basis of, you know, eventually we want your company to be worth more than it currently is, and we want you to be prepared to turn that value into cash so we can take our share back. And that's a really difficult thing for small developers, because that's not how small experiment developers think. It's not how small developers can think if they want to be experimental. That's about playing to the market in a very commercial fashion. So it is interesting to see a fund step in and do this, because there have been other indie funds, but not quite the same as what Moonrise is doing, I would say. I think this does look unique to me.
Yeah, I have their website up right now, and it's talking about how traditional profit sharing models work. You know, they make you take money out of your company on a fixed schedule. You're paying, a certain percentage of your monthly revenue or whatever to the investor or publisher. And it says specifically, we only want to get paid when the founders are also getting paid, ideally a very handsome amount when the time is right. We want to be in the founder's corner for the long term rather than backing in a way that feels more like a loan or a project-based financing where we would need to recoup quickly. So that's in their words, so that I'm not just, inventing things.
Yeah, no, that, I mean, Ben, that sounds like a much more accessible way to approach a broader range of developers with funding, because particularly like you see a lot of funding in, sectors like mobile, where you can play that industry by numbers alone, and a lot of the funding that flows through a space like that can be very rigid. It can be like, within 5 to 10 years we want to see this return on our investment, and that is difficult. That really does compromise you, particularly if you want to remain creative and experimental and keep pushing forward on your ideas.
Yeah, but I think like one of they weren't able to name really any of the people who were backing it, but one of the things that they did mention to me was that, several of the people who are backing it are independent developers who have already seen success in the space. So they're people who've already been through this, like they know what it's like, and they recognize the importance of this and the need for it. And that, I guess that was kind of another topic that I sort of wanted to weave into this one, is that, in the last several months, we've seen multiple instances of kind of, independent developers and publishers sort of recognizing that there is not just this gap in funding, but also kind of this gap in knowledge, and like kind of wanting to make strides to support people, coming up after them. So like we saw Raw Fury share its publishing agreement publicly, and then Whitethorn Digital did the exact same thing. And that was really interesting, because sharing those publicly meant that other people who are in independent development and publishing also came in and started like critiquing those things. And there was this whole conversation that was inspired by them doing that, where people were talking about what a good publishing agreement is and what it means. And that's like knowledge that, the kinds of people that like Moonrise Fund is targeting, like people who are just coming in and just, trying to start, they don't necessarily have that knowledge and that information. And there's not, really like, we're working on our academy, and I don't want to shortchange our academy, but it's hard to find like repositories of information like that. We also saw the Graffiti Games leaders, launch Indie Game Coach in November, which is a similar idea. Like, some of it is like consulting work, but also a lot of it is just, publishing like templates of documents, or like, here's, a budget template, or, here's like a business document that you might need. Have you ever thought of QA or localization costs? Make sure that you're including those. And again, it's just like, this kind of, I feel like between like kind of all these things, there's sort of this realization that developing games is really hard. And there is a segment of people who have really, really good ideas who it is even harder for, and we want to help them, I guess.
The Roy Fury publishing their publishing agreement, I thought, was a really interesting thing to do, and kind of a first, as far as I'm aware at least, and really a step in the right direction in what you were saying, Rebecca, of like sharing those resources, because I think what's needed for indies is maybe more transparency. I like when I talk to devs, to small devs for the academy, I often find that what they need is like very practical information. Like you said, Rebecca, again, like they want a budget sheet. They want to know like how much it costs to go to an event. I mean, very bad example because these do not exist anymore at the moment, but you know what I mean. So I thought that was really good to publish that. And there's been a lot of devs who analyzed that publishing agreement, gave even more advice. And they also created a whole part of their website that's dedicated to resources for other developers, which I thought was really good. And I thought that was all really cool because I think indies really want new ways to do things. They're a bit tired of the traditional make a game, find a publisher, find funding, and that's the only way to do it. In your Monrise Fund feature, Rebecca, I thought that was quite interesting because I thought they were inspired by worker cooperatives. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a super interesting aspect, and I think there's space for like new models of being organized as an indie developer that is more favorable for them, like collectives. And like a random example is Triple Topping, for instance, a developer of Welcome to Elk, that has everyone has the same salary in that. I mean, it's a different topic, I guess, but like every dev in the studio has the same salary, or like Mush and Twin is a cooperative as well. I just think there's a lot of things that dev can explore at the moment outside of the traditional boundaries. And things like what Row Fury did and Moonrise Fund are really steps in the right direction, I think.
I think for me, like seeing all this knowledge sharing really emphasizes that games development is a business, not an art or a hobby. And like, that's something, I'm sure that's something like everyone knows, like every indie who goes into, you know, comes out of uni or thinks, I've got a great a game idea, this is going to change the world. They know that they're going to have to do business rather than just making a game. But the years, like the amount of times in interviews I've heard someone say, like, you know, that the developers need to, indies specifically need to have like a business sense. They need to have an understanding of how a company runs. They need to understand it's not just making a game and then making it successful. The making it successful part is as much about business and it is about, running a company, sorting your finances, marketing, promotion, investment, securing more funding, like all these things. Like when you're sitting down with Unity or Unreal or Twine or whatever, those are probably not things you're thinking about. The allegory I'm inevitably going to use is indie publishing in terms of fiction and stuff. There are podcasts and courses and Facebook groups and blogs and everything which are like teaching you kind of the basics of business, like teaching you, like, right, you need to register yourself as a company, you need to think about how you're doing advertising, these are all the different stats you need to be following, you need to do this and that and the other to kind of be successful. And there are indies who are helping indies all over the place in that sector, and it's great to see more of that in games as well.
I was initially disagreeing with you because I thought you were saying that like a lot of people, you know, did know, like most people did know that they needed to also build a business. But I think that is like the kind of problem that is trying to be addressed here, is that, yeah, it seems like it seems simple enough. And you know, like there's a difference between, you know, sort of making games as a hobby and just something that you do because you think it's fun, but then deciding that you actually want to make a game that people notice and play and that sells. And yeah, I think that's the gap. And I don't want to diminish, you know, people who, you know, do have good business sense, but that's something that I hear very often in like these kinds of talks as well, James, is that, you know, people, they don't realize that there is this whole business side to it. And that seems to be the problem that, you know, folks like, you know, Ava and the folks at Raw Fury and all these other places are trying to address, is the fact that, you know, you can do this. You absolutely can do this, but you need resources and you need to be prepared.
That's the thing, isn't it? Like, if you don't have the business sense, you have two options. You either hire in someone with the business sense to help run that side of your independent studio, or you learn. And it's great to see more avenues for people to learn from.
How many people, when they start and decide, like, I'm going to get into the games industry, get in expecting to, you know, work at a AAA developer on their favorite franchises and kind of having that as the career path in mind? And if that's what you want to do, you don't really need to learn how to start up your own business. Just get in at Ubisoft or Activision or wherever, do whatever specific job they want you to do really well so you can get on the stuff you want to get on, and you can go your entire career without learning it. But so many developers in the indie space start sort of in that AAA space. They cut their teeth in there, that's what they want to do, and then they decide, like, you know what, this really isn't for me. I want to do something that's more personal, more control, all that. And then, you know, all of a sudden you're 30 years old and maybe you've squirreled away some money, but when did you have the time to actually go back and get the, you know, basics of business education that you maybe would have needed and would have gotten if you knew when you were a teenager, like, yeah, that's ultimately where I want to be.
Yeah. It's hard too, because like, I see why something like Moonrise Fund is risky, right? Because like, you very much have to trust in the sense of the person who's kind of agreeing to fund these projects, that they are going to know, you know, what things are going to ultimately do well and what teams are ultimately going to do well. And Ava said that too in the interview, that it requires a lot of trust. And I guess, you know, interviews and kind of like a little bit of vetting as well. Like, you don't, I don't want to like demean people or like diminish them, but like, you don't just want to throw money at every single idea on the piece of paper. Like some ideas are not good, or some people don't, you know, some people don't have like the follow through to do things, but a lot of them do. Like, again, to, I guess, go back to the example that was given of Hyperdot, like Hyperdot is incredible. It is like a very simple concept, right? Like, it's just moving the circle around a space and dodging things. But it's more than that, because, you know, you could making a game like that, you know, that's just kind of on mobile and not really thought through, where you just move a circle around and dodge things. Like, I'm sure many people have done that. But the thing that makes Hyperdot really stand out is the fact that, you know, money and energy were put into making it, one, very, very iterative on this one idea, right? So there's like a lot of different, there's a lot of different sort of new challenges that come up around this very, very simple idea. And it's, you know, playable for a very long time as a result, but also it's extremely accessible. Charles McGregor made a point to make this game that, you know, when I played it at PAX, whatever it was, PAX East, PAX West, I don't even remember. I think it was West. It was playable with the adaptive controller. Like, and it was, there was this whole point where it really only requires one input. You just have to be able to move something around. You don't have to do anything else. And that was incredible. Like, that is such an incredible thing that, you know, even if you're just making a very simple game, is not always thought through in such a wonderful way. But, you know, as was pointed out, like, that amount of care and attention can't really be done unless you have the funding and the support and the knowledge to take the time and do it. It's not just something you slap together in 5 minutes and throw on a game store somewhere. You need the support to make that kind of thing happen.
Yeah, that game's actually, it's playable with gaze tracking.
Oh, so, that's cool.
Like, if you have, what's so it, cool. Toby, it's the name of it, but they were giving them out to developers at GDC, and Charles McGregor was there and is like, hey, this sounds cool, I'll get it, and then just, you know, show my roommate developer and maybe we can do something cool with it. And they're like, hey, we can actually, you know, put this in the game, we can try that, and it worked well enough that they went through with it. But I think so much of the problem here, and we've kind of identified this, is just there are no end of barriers to developers getting into this industry. You can't make it cheap enough to get into the industry. You can't have funding for everyone. You can't have equal access to the education that people would need to learn the skills for game development. And the more that we can kind of lower those barriers, and the more initiatives like this that are out there to help these developers, that is absolutely fantastic. And I welcome them all. But it also, I think, is just sort of an intractable problem in the, you know, current setup, short of like having free education and universal basic income for everyone, and, you know,
yeah,
free computers. I think that's as well.
Yeah, like, I think that's a really, it's a good point, because, you know, in some way, I mean, it's easy with stuff like this to kind of start thinking in a bit of a utopian way, like, why can't, you know, every developer have the funding and the time and so on and so forth. But what something that Brendan kind of, you know, gestured towards, I mean, in many ways, a lot of this stuff is making the situation less imperfect rather than moving it towards a sort of a perfect place, because on a fundamental level it's going to be difficult or impossible to get to a point where everybody gets that fair shake, where there's funding for everybody and so on and so forth, simply because, and this is where the the problem does stretch back a decade or more. It's just because there are just, it's so, the tools and the platforms and so on, everything's so open, so accessible, that there is just too much of everything for everybody to be stable, mm-hmm. and for everybody to build a business, and for everybody to get funding and so on and so forth. A lot of these tools, what they are doing is trying to level the playing field a little bit more, so that the money that is there, the resources that are there, reach more people. But they're never ever going to reach everybody. And I'm not even just talking like hobbyists versus people that genuinely take it seriously. That, you know, good people doing good work are always going to get left behind. And that's true of every single cultural form right now. Batch is an aspiring novelist, for example, and I'm sure in your learning about, and my partner is a writer, aspiring novelist, screenwriter, and so on. And I'm sure Batch will say, just as my partner Laura tells me, like, it's not, you know, fair doesn't come into it, you know, in a lot of ways. Like, the best you can do is make things open, but in making things open, it actually does create a whole new raft of problems, which fundamentally may actually be impossible to solve. And what you can do is you can improve people's access to the parts that you can democratize. But, you know, there is a finite reserve of funding for a potentially infinite number of game developers. And that's kind of where you're always going to have a bit of a problem, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I do think it does sort of tap back into kind of one of the original problems I touched on a little bit when I was first talking about Moonrise, is that, you know, the people who are going to, who more often are going to already have access to the resources or know how to find them, or, you know, be able to take the time to make interesting games, are disproportionately going to be the people who are already privileged in our society. So, you know, there's, you know, when women tend to get stuck with the bulk of childcare for whatever reason, or, you know, when people of color are disadvantaged in terms of things like education or, you know, any other resources available to them, you know, they're inevitably the ones that we're going to see less of when it comes to something like this, where there's a monetary barrier, there's an experience barrier, and there's a resources barrier.
I think that's actually one of the things. Yeah. Hmm? I was just going to say, because I think one of the things that came out of our Game Changers project last year is that the nature of games, so one of the reasons why there are so many developers and there's so many games and so many stores is because everything's open now. Like, you can be a US developer, but you're selling on the same store as someone who's based in the Philippines, for example. And one of the people that contributed, Gwen Foster, said that, like, probably the single biggest inequality in the games industry is this lack of recognition that it's an international marketplace, but there still are national divisions in terms of opportunity. So, for example, like, while obviously there are people on varying scales of privilege within a country like the US, almost everyone in the US is going to have a better chance of meeting Valve, for example, than a developer in Southeast Asia. So the more you kind of look at it, the more you realize there are, like, the difficulty of leveling the playing field properly and truly is actually very, very hard. Because even, you know, my being based in the UK, and but Brendan and Rebecca, you both being based in North America, we still tend to think in local terms about a lot of issues. But a lot of this opportunity needs to be spread internationally, even beyond kind of societal demographics. It needs to go international as well. And there are whole regions of the world where, if you're, I think Gwen said, I don't have it in front of me now, you know, if you are unlucky enough to be born in the wrong country, you have so much a harder time to build stable career in the games industry. And that's something I think doesn't really get discussed very much. And that's something that these kinds of solutions can help with, like War Fury's publishing contract. I mean, someone making games in Vietnam, say, could probably go to every show in Southeast Asia and never run into War Fury. So that stuff being online makes a huge, huge difference to someone in that position.
That even goes down to a regional level. So, for example, you know, last 5+ years, anytime I've seen any kind of fund announced for developers or startups in the UK, if it is limited to London only, I always see complaints from developers and stuff that I follow, you know, developers and people I follow on Twitter from outside London complaining about that. So, like, even if you are privileged enough to be born and based or live in the UK, you may not be privileged enough to be in the area where the funding is. Like, they, you know, there's still an imbalance even on that level.
Yeah, that's why I found it quite interesting this year, last year and this year also, to have events and all sorts of different things being moved online. Because I feel like, I mean, there's other issues with that, of course, but it has created an opportunity for voices that typically are not heard to actually be heard and be represented in a way that wasn't the case if they had to travel to another continent, right? So obviously it can be a challenge as well, but I think that's been quite interesting. And I think whatever happens in the future now with events, I hope this digital component is actually going to stay for that reason, because it's made it so much more accessible for all sorts of people across the world.
Yeah, I was just going to add that that's a problem with Moonrise as well. You can, according to the website, you can live anywhere, but they seriously recommend or require that the company is either formed as or converted to a U.S. entity. And they say on the website too that, you know, they want to back creators from other countries too, but there's challenges, there's costs of navigating laws across, you know, all different countries, and you know, it's a small group of people who are just, you know, trying to do their best. And so that's like, it's hard, you know, you want to make things as global as possible, but there are challenges associated with that too. I think it's hard. I mean, obviously it's hard. Like that's kind of the whole point of this discussion. And my inclination is I want to end a discussion on a positive note. Like I want to be like, oh, here's a solution. Here's the thing that we can do to make things better. But I mean, the answer is, you know, I want more things to exist like Moonrise Fund. I love that I am seeing kind of this trend of, you know, independent studios, independent developers who have made it, who have done the thing, who are now turning around and offering their resources, their knowledge, their funding, you know, their connections, whatever they can offer, to build people up who are coming up behind them. Like, I think that's one way in which things succeed. And I also, like, kind of tied into this discussion, I'm hoping that, you know, this trend continues, and I hope that it ends up with us seeing more, I guess, like, weird games, you know, make it. We talked about Hyperdot a lot, and I know there's plenty of examples of this, but I keep going back to the fact that I played at PAX East, again, this is in 2020, this is before the pandemic. I played this game at the Indie Mini Booth, and it was called Evergreen Blues, and I wrote a feature about it, and it's a free game. I think it's on Steam right now. But it's this fascinating little game, and all it is these two characters singing to one another, and you pick the lyrics. You can play co-op. Each person plays, you know, a character who's singing, and you pick the lyrics as you go along, and the characters will sing them, and they will put them together into the song, and that's the game. That's it. But it was incredible. Cool. And me just describing it makes it sound like sort of ridiculous, but I cannot like explain to you what an amazing experience playing that game was. Like it's got like 5 or 6 levels, doesn't have that many levels. But just playing through, you know, several minutes of the song that I was building myself as I went, was just, it was moving and it was beautiful. And I really, really enjoyed it. And I, you know, again, I don't know what their situation is. I don't know how they developed that. I don't know what kind of funding they had. But I just think, you know, an experience like that, I think most investors, like if someone was looking to, you know, try to get funding for something like that, I feel like most investors would look at that and be like, you know, what is this? Like, why would I give money to this? Like, what's the hook?
Well, I mean, but I think it's more like, because any investor, and, you know, I Moonrise are coming out with a different head on. But they're still they've still got a fund, and if that fund returns their money, then they can't help any more people. So even they're going to be like, what's the market? What's the audience size? So on and so forth. And I think that's always been the challenge, because, you know, we've been talking broadly about indies so far, but, you know, I was going to say early on that actually indies who purely want, you know, are very focused on being experimental it's a kind of a different set of problems for them, because no matter where you're taking your investment from, you're going to encounter problems if your goal isn't really to kind of seek out and find an audience. Actually, another piece you wrote just recently, Rebecca, about Pacer, the guy in that talking about funding this game, I thought it's a fairly obvious point in some way, but he's like, why haven't we had games like this? And he did his research and he realized, well, you know, that Wipeout sold 750,000 copies, and for some investors that wouldn't even be enough to, you know, to pique interest. But from his perspective, it's like, but you can sell 600, but that just means that there's a possibility of selling 600,000 copies of a game like this, and that's fine. And obviously that's a completely another level to a game like Evergreen Blues. And those kinds of games have been around for a long, long time. And I remember even pre kind of pre-App Store, Steam was still relatively small and entirely curated by Valve. I was covering games by like Tale of Tales, this Belgian studio, Jason Rohrer would be an example from the American indie community back then. They were often funded by grants, local government funding and that kind of stuff, because those grants are rewarded on the basis of art and pure creativity and not with a return in mind. And as soon as you get to a funding, I mean, I suppose grant funding is funding, but I think we're talking about people who have a pot of money, who've made that money from being in business. It doesn't matter how good their kind of intentions are, you know, and obviously the better their intentions are, the better in general, but they want that fund to kind of be replenished so they can keep on funding other games. So at some point, there's always going to be a moment where they say, okay, well, who's this appealing to and could it sell and so on and so forth. And even the best, even the most altruistic versions of this always have that point. But grant funding and government funding, and where I was based in Berlin for 3 years, Germany's just had like a big new national federal funding program approved this year, 50 million euros a year, which is going to change that country's industry. Prior to that, it was all about where you were based. If you were in Berlin, the Medium Board Brandenburg made Berlin one of the best places in Germany to be a small experimental developer, because they would give you 80,000 euros. And that means two of you could work for a year on a game. And it didn't matter what it was, because you don't have to pay it back and it's not based on projections or anything like that. The goal was to make Berlin a great place to be an experimental indie developer. And that changes the game entirely. I think when you talk about games like Evan Green Blues, I think it's important to ask the question, what kind of funding do you think should be open to games like that? Because I think part of what makes a game like that so special is it's not really made in a way that would naturally lend itself to a PowerPoint presentation with pie charts about markets and stuff. It's an expression of a creative idea. That's what makes it special.
What's interesting is that there are like initiatives that support experimental games, but it's a matter of knowing that they exist. Like you mentioned Berlin, and as part of Amaze Berlin, they actually have this thing called Amaze Bazaar, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, which is like an international art house games market is how they describe it. And that connects developers of artistic and political games, again, a quote, with publishers, funding institutions, art institutions, and collaborators, whatever they mean by that. But the goal here is just to allow developers to do more experimental stuff and to make a living out of it, whether that's by being funded, being published, but also maybe being featured like in a museum, which would be a completely different approach, which might make more sense for a very experimental or artistic type of game. And so like these things exist. I think Amaze Berlin is like a great example of what you can do in the experimental space. I think it's a great event. But there's also Ask Games with which was featured in our GI 100 list, which is an organization in Spain which explore games in relation with art, radical thinking, like politics and stuff like that. And that's another space for developers to experiment with games, not necessarily as something you want money for, if that makes sense, which I guess is a slightly different topic. But I think there's stuff that exists. There's initiatives that explore how you can be experimental and still be seen and experienced by people, but they're niche and it's tough to find them. And I feel like it's weird because it's easier than ever to make a game, and because everything is so accessible, as we mentioned already, and even the financial barriers are a bit lower, I feel, than they were in, like 5-10 years ago. But I feel like this accessibility hasn't led to a better accessibility to funds, which is everything we've talked about so far. I think it's a bit frustrating that everything is much easier, but at the same time much more difficult, because there's more and more great indie games and more experimental stuff, in my opinion at least, but there's still not a lot of people to actually give money for these projects.
Yeah, I guess just like beyond money, like I want more barriers to come down, because I personally want to play more games like that. Like I don't know. I'm someone who really, really enjoys just weird, surprising games. So at the end of last year, there was a thing that was going around. A lot of people were talking about crunch. I think it was when the Cyberpunk stuff came out. So, you know, Twitter was of course talking a lot about, you know, AAA crunch and, you know, how it's bad. And so there's a tweet going around that's, what is it? I want shorter games with worse graphics made by people who are paid more to work less, and I'm not kidding. And And somebody decided that they wanted to get people to put their money where their mouth is. So they started a game jam on Itch, and they let people submit games. And the only they put it together in a bundle, basically, and sold the bundle called the Shorter Games with Worse Graphics Bundle. And the only rules for submission were, you know, no Nazi or prejudice shit, obviously. Nothing that's had a publishing deal. Commercial, you know, games that actually, you know, are charging something for them. They want people who are trying to make money. And then I don't care if the game is good, how pretty it is, or how long it is. I just ask that it's somewhat complete. And so I'm going through, you know, this list of games that were submitted, and some of these, I'm like, I bought the bundle, and I'm like, I haven't played any of them yet, but I'm really excited to play them. Like, what's this one? I have low stats, but my class is leader, so I recruited everyone I know to fight the Dark Lord. It's an RPG where you recruit then, all these 99 people to fight the Dark Lord with you. That sounds amazing. Who would ever fund that?
But the thing is, but does anybody need to fund that? Apart from
the person creating it,
don't get me wrong, okay? Because one of the things about this topic that I kind of found hard to wrap my head around is because on some level, like literally everybody here loves to see experimental game design and to see indies doing well. Like it's a non-controversial topic in that way, right? So what we're really kind of talking about is like from a much more objective remove. Like, okay, well, where does kind of reality insert itself into the path of creativity, and how does it get in its way, and how does it create inequalities, and all of these kinds of stuff? I mean, Itch itself is kind of proof that there is a place, and there are games that are being made in their thousands that are experimental and so on. But there is a point at which, well, I mean, if we accept the fact that there are too many games, you know, to literally fund, like literally too many to be able to fund, then at what point does funding come into it, and what should the terms of that funding be? I suppose that's the question I've often asked myself with smaller developers, you know, and going back to my point about people like Jason Rohrer and Tale of Tales, we're talking like 13 years ago. I mean, the idea of indie barely even existed at that point, and I don't think it would even have occurred to those people to look for funding to the industry. They look to local government, they look to museums and art galleries and that kind of stuff instead. And all of that sort of stuff still exists, and there is more opportunity than ever before to get more experimental work funded. But how could a system exist that could fund every developer on Itch, right? Like it's
I don't think that's what I'm asking for. But I guess this is where I circle back to Moonrise Fund, right? Like Ava says that they are interested in people who are thinking bigger or thinking differently about play. And they're trying to be open to the possibilities. And I guess, like, you know, some people just want to be, you know, kind of goofy and experimental and, you know, make things that, you know, are interesting but maybe aren't good in like the AAA sense or whatever. And that's like fine. But I do think that there's room for the games industry to sort of open itself up a little more to new ideas of what a game could be on a higher funding level than, you know, just like what's on Itch, right? Like I would like to see, but you don't think that
has happened? Raw Fury, Devolver Digital, I mean, you know, every single indie publisher. I mean, we're kind of in danger of saying there's AAA and then there's games on Itch and not appreciating that there's like every other kind of game, and the availability of funding actually stops fairly far down that chain. I may kind of have the wrong head on there. Like I feel like Raw Fury puts out games of a fairly interesting and experimental.
No, they do. Like I'm not trying to just knock the whole AA and like independent industries. They're doing wonderful stuff. I don't know. I think there's room to get a little weirder, and I am happy to see that Moonrise is open to that, I guess, is all I'm trying to say. I don't think I'm trying to say anything more complicated than that.
No, and I think it does make me recall a conversation I had a long time ago with Mike Rose, who went on to fund Build No More Robots, and he was still a journalist at Gamma Sutra at that time, and he was saying, and this guy, I guess this was like early 2010, something like 2012, somewhere around there, and he was just saying that like there are so many games, there are more than could ever be successful, but on a fundamental level, like there's such the biggest skills gap in independent game development, indie game development, smaller studios, is marketing. And that he believed, And he's kind of proved this, I think, with the kind of games that No More Robots have handled. I mean, they've handled something like Descenders, which is a very polished product, but also stuff like Not Tonight, which is like a Brexit simulator, and Yes, Your Majesty, which is very, very different. He was telling me back then, and he proved it with his company, this was before No More Robots. He thinks that almost any game can succeed at market, but you do need to have to know how to market. And I kind of think that's as almost as important as funding itself, really. I recall a talk from Cassia Curran from Wings that she did at one of our events. I think it was an investment summit, which was just about, like, this is how you sort of assess and prove the size of the potential market for your game. And that could be applied to anything. It could be applied to something very small and experimental. But it really kind of showed you, actually, you don't need to even be a publisher to get the basics of this down. And Micros, I think, is kind of has an unusually adept mind at stuff like marketing. But he was only a journalist at one point, and then like 3 years later he's running his own publishing company. It's just because he saw that no one is really trying hard at this stuff in indie development, and that it doesn't, you know, you can get the basics that can put you in a much better position to make money for yourself just by learning. I think it's something that James was saying earlier on, that you either need to kind of join forces with someone who can do this stuff, or you do need to devote as much time to learning it as you maybe would to kind of building the game itself. It's difficult because in the absence of that funding, the responsibility falls on your own shoulders. But we do live in an age where you can actually take that responsibility on and fill the gap for yourself. It's not ideal, but it is an option.
Yeah, which is why I would like to see kind of one of the things that was talked about in Moonrise Fund, and I'm sure it already exists, but I would like to continue to see that kind of thing extended. You know, Ava was telling me about how, you know, within this sort of, you know, thing, the games that they fund, they're, you know, trying to basically put together, you know, kind of a support network for people where, you know, they're, you know, they have people to reach out to. And again, you know, many of the advisors on this fund are people who have already made it in the indie space. They have, like, you know, it's not just these kind of mysterious investors from outside somewhere who don't necessarily, you know how to make a game, but, you know, it's people who do and people who you can reach out to, you know, for advice and support. And I know there are probably many of those networks already in the games industry. But I also think that it can probably be a little bit difficult to find them if you're just showing up for the first time. And so I like the idea of having, you know, that option of just, you know, having people to ask, you know, what do I do? How do I approach this? How do I market this? You know, what kinds of questions do I even need to be asking in the first place?
Yeah. I agree. I actually think that might even be the most important piece to get in place first, right? Beyond just like people like, and you're right. And I think the existence of something like Moonrise is kind of a passage of time thing, right? Like the sorts of people that can start a Moonrise fund made money from a trend that only even started in like 2008, right? So you've got, and then you've had like the Treasure Hunters fund, the indie fund, like you've had people that have done well in the indie and independent sectors, if we take indie to mean even smaller teams, right? That they then get in a position where they can help people coming up behind. I think Team Supot did exactly the same thing. But those kinds of people have only been around for only so much time. So I do think you are going to see more and more of that in place. But that will take that. But that's a matter of time passing, I think. But right now, what the Raw Fury contract being shared and that kind of thing, that's the sort of thing that can be changed tomorrow. And you know, helping people to understand, giving them the knowledge, the tools to make the right decisions, just in terms of, you know, just on intellectual terms, not necessarily just the financing, though I think that probably will become better and better over time.
At the risk of taking us on one more tangent, like, I think part of the barrier when we come to marketing, like, one of the barriers of marketing obviously is budget, but then there's also reach. So essentially getting your game out there and covered by the press or influencers, that is a form of marketing. Like, you know, it's not paid for, or at least not always paid for. But you know, getting your game out there and again, raising the awareness among your potential audience, that's a major barrier. And that's something that Rebecca was discussing in the email chain where we were talking about this as a topic for the podcast. That is something I think is an issue in terms of, like, most of the traditional publications don't cover a lot of these weird, wacky, experimental games. You'll have the exception to the Rock, Paper, Shotguns. We cover a fair amount of this, but we're covering it purely from a business side of things rather than informing consumers about these games' existence. The Guardian does a fairly good job when it goes to, like, an event. It's like, hey, here's all these wacky, experimental games we've played. But beyond that, there's not a great deal. And if you look at, like, all the biggest publications, the biggest influencers, they all tend to focus on the most popular titles, the games that are already popular, because then that's what grows their own audience. And it's this weird cycle of, you know, the media and the influencers seeking what people already like in order to get more attention, and therefore that coverage of games that people already like is drowning out ones that people might like.
Sorry, I was trying to find... Heather Alexandra had a Twitter thread about this recently because the conversation came up. I found it. There was a conversation on Twitter recently that Heather Alexandra, formerly of Kotaku, I think currently working at Double Fine, had just this really good thing to say about it, you know, talking about why websites struggle to cover, you know, smaller games. It's not that journalists don't want to. She wrote, to give context, I consider 30 to 45,000 views a good article. 20,000 is okay. 100,000 is very good. This is not an industry held truism, but it's what I feel. Indie game articles consistently struggled to reach over 10K without an amazingly good hook. Many didn't even get 2,000 in readers. I don't think the numbers game is a good way to do your journalism. You write things because they deserve to be written about. Indie game coverage is essential to properly covering games as a culture. Cool. Now go tell that to your editors and see what happens. And she's kind of right. I mean, I know we have sort of a different, you know, we have a different business model, and we are, you know, very, very fortunate in that we are able to cover things that we feel are important over, you know, trying to play some kind of numbers game. But most websites aren't like that, and it's because websites have to survive. And that this is like a whole other topic that we could talk about for like an hour.
Yeah, I mean, this is another topic. I mean, it's odd because I feel like a Kotaku, a Polygon, a Eurogamer, they can actually afford to do more of this than they do. I mean, just because, you know, we know a little bit about who gets ad deals and so on and so forth. And definitely there is a sort of a monopoly effect in terms of where the revenue flows into the games media too. And there are some websites that do really well, and they're most really, really struggle. And I've often thought I would... Not every article that flows through a Polygon necessarily needs to do good numbers. Like, I think you can give up a little bit more room to stuff that you just think it's important that should be out there. And I do wish there was a little bit more of that, because, you know, on the one end you have squeezing every hit for dollars, and on the other end you have public interest. Public service broadcasting, right? That's a sliding scale, and I think it's the role of any enthusiast website to choose. Okay, where do we fall on this? And some of that's dictated by their own finances and the financial position they're in. And maybe I don't know enough about, say, like a Polygon or a Kotaku to be able to comment. But I don't want to misread Heather Alexander there, because I imagine that what the case is. Everyone on Kotaku did write those kinds of articles, but they wish they could have written more of them. But at a certain point, you can only write so many. And if that's the case, then that is absolutely fair enough, because I think that's the way it should be. They play a different numbers game to us, where we don't actually pay. Because for us, we'd be happier if 2,000 people read one of our articles, and that's exactly the people that we wanted to reach with that article, we are happier than if 10,000 randoms who just kind of found it via Twitter read it, because we don't monetize our traffic in the same way. So we're in a bit of a luxurious position, because we get to act a bit more like the BBC or something, where we go, well, this is, you know, to educate, inform and entertain and all that kind of stuff. And like, it's a different world, I think, and it must be a very high stress one. I think what Heather's expressing there, I mean, it must be difficult to swallow sometimes, right? Like, you know, there's this thing here, and you want to be able to cover it and give it the time, but, you know, you've already done that for so many games this week, and you now need to make sure that the numbers are looking right. And that must be a difficult thing to deal with.
I want more weird games. I want more weird games. I want more people to know about them. That's it.
I agree. I want more weird games. Like when you were talking earlier about Evergreen Blues, like that's the sort of thing that I'd love to try out. One more barrier that stands against me, and this may be just me coming from how I personally game, is the vast majority of these games, and particularly the ones you were talking about, particularly all the stuff on Itch, are on PC. PC is less than a quarter of the market in terms of like your revenues generated and so forth. Like, and I know indie games, experimental games don't necessarily need these multiple £1,000 hefty rigs. But I don't have a PC. I don't have I don't have any computer device that can run a game with any confidence. I have two laptops. They can barely handle like retro games that I've bought from like GOG years ago. Like, so the idea of trying experimental games, I just don't have the facilities to play them. Whereas I do have consoles, I do have mobile, and these are less open as ecosystems, and that's a whole different topic. And Epic versus Apple, Epic versus Google, that sort of thing. We may well be discussing this topic on another week in very different terms, depending on how that case comes out. But the fact that those are closed ecosystems, and yes, you're getting more indie games on Xbox, on Switch, on so forth, but they don't tend to be these weird, wacky, experimental ones, and they tend to be harder to find, in my experience, than there's another Mario game. I know what that is. I'll buy it.
But this is just an example of, like, the medium is the message, right? Like, those... You've answered your own question insofar as they're closed ecosystems, so therefore these games aren't there. Because the reason where these games spring up on is... And, you know, even Flash used to provide this service. Places like Newgrounds, you get lots of very weird experimental stuff over there because it's open. And people can just put stuff there. And you don't actually need funding to do that bit. You kind of need funding to polish it up and develop it and make it a product that you could potentially sell to somebody. But also, and I think this is an important part to address, what you just said, Batch, about it's only a quarter of the market. But you know what I mean? Like, a game like Evergreen Blues probably doesn't need to sell more than 20,000 copies. I know it's free, but what I'm saying is, even if the person that made that equated their time per hour and actually thought, well, this has cost me this much, what would I need to make it back? You wouldn't need to be on console to do that. So I think that, again, there's a danger, like, you end up collapsing the games market and making it into like a homogenous whole. It's not, it's huge, it's diverse, and that accounts for the business side too. And it's really just about how you look at success. I think a lot of weird experimental games, I think there's an audience for everything. The difficulty is connecting to that audience. And I think there's an audience that will buy most things, so long as those things are experimental, yes, but also kind of like well conceived and executed and stuff. And I think most people would, and that audience would buy it. But the thing is, how do you find that audience? How do you communicate with that audience? I don't think you need publishers or funders for that necessarily. I think the funding is a slightly different thing. But what is success, right? Like, the people that make games like that, I don't think are thinking, I want this to be a breakout hit and sell a million copies. I think making that game's cost back and enough to make the next game and a living, that is success in indie development now. That's what success is. It's not selling 100,000 copies. It's selling 10,000 copies and being able to make your next game. That's what success is.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's probably where a lot of people would fall. I do think, you know, there are people who would like to not just make the thing that they want to make and have it, you know, do okay and move on to the next one. But I think there are people who genuinely want to see the ways that we think about play and the ways that we think about game development and games themselves change and broaden. And that's I guess what I was digging at earlier, is I would like to see that understanding continue to deepen, and I would like to see those games continue to find, you know, more success in terms of just recognizability and acceptance of, you know, games that are not the mainstream. I don't know, doing well and being known. I would like to see that continue to evolve over time. And I think things like the Moonrise Fund, where, you know, you have someone at the top with money saying, I want to see different kinds of play. Specifically, I want to see that. Like bring me things that are not what I expect. If you've got some kind of playable spreadsheet, I'll give it a try. You know, just bring me that. I like that somebody with money is specifically asking for that and being willing to give that money to that. And I don't know, I'm excited for, like, I don't know, 5-10 years down the line when we start to see the fruits of that. that's probably about as far as we can take the discussion without devolving into like 20 different ones. You can always go back and listen to previous episodes of this podcast on all good podcasting platforms. Once you're on that good podcasting platform, consider subscribing, so it'll let you know whenever another episode appears. And I think we should have one more game developers playlist coming up from me here in a couple weeks, probably. I've got Gene Leggett coming on to talk about Tex Murphy Adventures, and that'll be on the exact same feed. And James, what's your five games of? What's the most recent one of those?
So this week, this coming Thursday, we will finally be releasing the five games of Jesper Kidd, the composer behind Assassin's Creed, Borderlands, and a bunch of other games that I've had in the bag for a while, but I just haven't got around to editing. It is this Thursday.
At last. That's all on the same feed, so, you know, if you go find the GamesIndustry.biz podcast, it'll let you know whenever any of that shows up. And you can and should get your daily dose of news and insight into the world behind games at GamesIndustry.biz.